This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 1st of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 90th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. What kind of theme can we pretend we've had at a planning meeting for this week's show? Aha, I know. Today's show, ladies and gentlemen, is all about learning. Here's how we'll make that mud stick. We'll hear from one of Britain's finest contemporary artists, Ryan Gander, on his grand plan for a great new art school.
So there's six of them there at any one time, and they stay 5 months, and they get like a studio. Then there's communal facilities, you know, workshops. There's a cafe open to the public, a gallery, a library, project space, a glass-covered courtyard, which is like a forum for lectures and debates and things.
While we're facing front and scribbling copious notes, learning, see? We'll speak to film director Mike Figgis about his new movie and how to make one.
I wanted to shoot it on the latest technology, because every time you make a film, it's an opportunity to actually try things and to push them to sort of levels that you wouldn't if you're just testing it for 3 minutes or something like that.
And before we start passing notes and flicking ink down the back of the chemistry master's lab coat, we'll learn how to make the big small. If you were to invent a new metaphor for this, it couldn't be more perfect than what we witnessed in Berlin. Opera in someone's sitting room.
She have a really nice flat with high ceiling and a piano. And then I ask her, you know, can I come and sing in your apartment? I'll bring a couple of singers and whatnot.
That's putting the cozy in cozy fantuti, right? And we'll have a live session from Finland's Sansa. We'll visit the Korean neighbourhood that's a veritable indie pop factory. And we'll welcome back a minute of sound with a 60-second dash around a Lebanese music festival. Geez, we're packed on this show, my friends. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. It's not often that the itchy feet of Midori House are glued to the spot for one of our weekly sessions. It's also not often that one person manages to give the illusion they're not alone on stage. But this week's performance from Finnish singer Sansa, who's been a staple on the M24 playlist for some time, but don't let that put you off, was something quite special. She was over in London recently, playing a few dates, so we couldn't resist inviting her into Midori House to wow us with her looping skills and powerful vocals. First up, here she is with Vision.
Life's gone in a flash. Live in the moment, don't care of the past. Don't sleep your future away. Don't listen too much to what your mom says. Don't listen too much to what your daddy says. Create your own vision. Let it set you free. Shallow ground. Forget your head in clouds. Don't be afraid to step out of your comfort zone. Don't be afraid to step out of your comfort zone. Create your own vision. Let it set you free. Change is happening. Save
That was Sansa with Vision. And as you know, because you tune in every week, faithful listeners, we'll be enjoying some more of that special session later on in the show. So from Finnish vocals, we move a little closer to home now to hear about the worlds of entrepreneurship and artistic creativity colliding. What's taken more cold cuts than a Lyonnais charcuterie, our beloved coalition government in the UK? That's who. And what's been hit hard? Well, art schools for one. We're not saying there aren't others, but hey cats, this is the culture show. And British artist Ryan Gander wants to do something about it. He lives and works between London and Saxmundham on England's East Anglian coast and wants to start a brand new world-class art school in a former schoolhouse there. What and why and when and how? Exactly. Katie and I trotted over to Ryan's studio in East London to see what's what.
Please wait. Your call is in progress.
Hello, Ryan Gander.
Call from door panel.
Hi, we've come to visit Ryan Gander in his secret underground lair.
Hi, guys. Hello. Hello.
Hi, Ryan. I'm Rob.
Hey, how's it going?
How's it going? Nice to meet you.
It's basically to give six artists the opportunity to become professional artists, self-sustaining artists, so they don't have to teach and do other jobs. They can, you know, make their money and their living at making arts, which is what I do, which is like an incredibly privileged position to be in, I think. So there's six of them there at any one time, and they stay 5 months, and they get like a studio. Then there's communal facilities, you know, workshops. There's a cafe open to the public, a gallery, a library, project space, a glass-covered courtyard, which is like a forum for lectures and debates and things. And then there's a, it's all one building built on two courtyards, and attached to it there's an accommodation block. And the rooms in that, there'll be 16 rooms, so that the participants can live there. But then there's extra rooms for advisors to come and stay and, you know, do a day's talking and then stay for supper prepared by the participants. But also then there's enough room for smaller projects, like maybe some graphic designers from the Netherlands come over and do a project, or curators from a curating course. And it's very free and open and up in the air, and it's really by, not even application, but just by a letter to the, you know, the direction of the...
Right.
And if it has artistic merit and the people who are asking for it are in real need of the opportunity, then it's granted. It's a bit like Art Heaven.
It is like Art.
These are the floor plans by the architects. We've got these two young architects working on it.
How finished are you thinking in your head the artists are going to be by the time they turn up to Saxmundham?
Yeah, well, I don't want them to have a profile. I want it to be open, so age shouldn't be a restriction, or previous education shouldn't be a restriction. It's basically based on two principles, and one is artistic excellence and the other is need. So it's not really for people who are financially able to carry on practicing on their own. It's for people who would end up in Allied Carpets in the next few weeks ordering deep shag.
Which is also a type of tobacco.
Yeah, it is, you're
right. Either, you don't want to get those two confused.
We'll say
don't
pile,
smoke
then. Deep pile. Differentiate. I've always wanted to set up an art school. I don't really know why. I think it's because when I was younger I found myself working in Allied Carpets and ended up at a place called the Rijksacademie in Amsterdam, which was a sort of residency programme, a really good opportunity. You know, you got an allowance to live on, a place to live in a studio, and technicians to help you and things like that. And I don't know, I've always felt a little bit indebted and guilty about it. I've always been interested in wanting to open, you know, some sort of residency programme or art school. And it's a pretty good time to do it now. And I live in Saxmundham, which is a small town on the coast in Suffolk, with my wife and my kid. And my wife was wandering around this town one day where we live, and she found this old Victorian school that's derelict, and she came home and she said, "I've got an amazing place for your art school." So I went to see it, and it started there, really. So I had this idea that it'd be a daftly ambitious project, but maybe achievable. And then I met a bloke in Waitrose in the town called Simon Turnbull, who's a...
Allied Carpets and Waitrose have already starred in your narrative about urban art school. But I like the way that
drop the Waitrose
from these
you
know,
Tesco in
from these ordinary well. Kind of beginnings. Great art schools, you know, thrive.
So I was in Waitrose looking at the cauliflowers, and a man tapped me on the shoulder and said that he'd read something in the Financial Times where I'd mentioned that I wanted to open an art school in Saxmundham. And I said, yeah, but I need a few million quid. It's like quite a big project. And he said, I can help you with that. That's what I do. Big projects. And it turned out he did. And he knows quite a lot. All the stuff I don't know. And I know all the stuff he doesn't know. So it's a partnership made in heaven. There's a lot of people who enjoy collecting art, and they're very busy people, and they find it hard to find the times to go to all the art fairs and do the massive amount of research and da 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 da. And at this school, over a 10-year period, we'll have 120 artists going through it. So my idea was to ask each of these artists to make a piece of work that they thought was representative of their stay, their 6 months at the school. And that would go into it. They'd gift it to the Fairfield International. This is the school. And it would become part of the Fairfield International Legacy Collection. And then those 120 works we could swap for the cost of... Because the build cost of the school is quite high because it's a good school. The idea is that it's a ready-built collection that could be traded for currency, and the currency would produce the school. But the nice thing about that is it's almost like... It's not just a collection, it's a collection that is the history of 10 years of the school. And effectively, the collector is buying something that doesn't exist yet. So by buying something that they haven't seen, there's that leap of faith and that belief as well. So it echoes really well with the whole concept of the school. And of course, there's a nice economy to it, because the collector that decides to give the money for the 120 works that aren't made yet, they're also, by giving the money, investing in the artist that will make the works, and therefore they're investing in the value of their own collection. That doesn't exist yet. It sounds like Back to the Future.
It does sound like Back to the Future. I love the idea of this. This is the kind of thing that could. This is the school that could only be set up by a successful practicing artist, though. Knowing the connections between the value of your work, the market, and having a network of collectors and the gallery thing and all the rest of it. This is presumably. It's things like this. It's Venn diagrams in your head like this that are the things that aspiring artists don't yet know, but what they'll learn at the school as well, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of experience and knowledge, really, that's built up, isn't it? I mean, we all know that our education in the UK is a bit messed up at the moment, and it'll be impossible for anyone without money to ever go to art school soon. And it's all well and good, you know, waving placards and protesting, but actually, if there's a problem with something, it's much better just to do something, isn't it? Something positive and make something happen rather than moan about what's not happening. And you can do things like guerrilla tactics. But I also think, because I have this knowledge of the inside and the economies and the systems that are at play within the art world and in education, that it's better just to do it from the inside out, you know, and use this system that already exists to make the best possible situation for artists. But we've got some really good people working on it. We're just setting up a sort of friends council, which Anish Kapoor is helping us with, to raise that money. He's been really great. I mean, great guy. He's really interested in the idea, and obviously he's in a position to be able to introduce the project to people that might be able to help us. If anyone's got a million quid.
That was Ryan Gander, and we'll be catching up again with him as Fairfield International School begins to take shape later on in the year. Or if you've got a spare million quid you'd like to give him for the project, just drop me an email, rb@monocle.com, and I'll give you my sort code and account number, of course. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Next, we're sitting down for a good old chinwag with Mike Figgis.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Who wants to know about the future of feature films? Who wants to hear from a legendary but at the same time very real director on that very subject? And others. Well, your dial's stuck on a sweet spot then, cats. The director of Leaving Las Vegas, The Browning Version and Time Code, Mike Figgis, swung by our studios last week to talk about his new movie, Suspension of Disbelief, why small's beautiful, camera-wise, and the matter with modern movie making. Hit it, Mike.
I wanted to shoot it on the latest technology, because every time you make a film, it's an opportunity to actually try things and to push them to sort of levels that you wouldn't if you were just testing it for 3 minutes or something like that. Basically, you take a stills camera, you take it as the center of a module, and you build on top of it, and you put as much stuff on it as you want, really. Monitors, you know, cinema lenses, etc. The camera then becomes the smallest thing within the sort of bulk of the equipment.
This infrastructure.
Yeah. It's really just a recording device. That's all it is.
Which I guess it always was. Yeah. But there we have this great romantic idea of directors and clapperboards, and there's a certain type of chair that you have to sit on. There's a certain type of apparatus that you need in order to be able to do your job, Mike. Is it strange and slightly a little bit of a letdown to suddenly realise that it is essentially a recording device? Does it set you free?
Yeah.
Maybe?
No, I mean, to me, it was the good news. I was never a fan of the other stuff, the trucks and the guys with the belts and the generators and the massive amount of equipment that predominantly men, amass around them when they're making a film. It's like they really think they're in the army.
It's a bit of a barrier, right?
It's a huge barrier because, the thing about filmmaking, like any creative process, is a kind of relationship between energy, creativity, practicality, budget, time.
There's a lot of pragmatism in there, practicality.
Yeah. And that was always what was exciting to me about film, was you are dealing with a number of people and suddenly it's raining, and what do you do? How do you adapt very, very quickly? And for me, going into filmmaking late from performance art, I couldn't wait to get off 35mm and onto 16mm, because that represented, again, a return to a certain kind of energy and speed. The new digital kind of technology that turned up, I immediately started testing it. This was around 2000, 2001. Made a film on it, Time Code, then made another film, Hotel, and then really just got stuck in once I realized the image quality was not just good enough, it was actually quite extraordinarily good and had its own kind of vibrancy and its own sort of genre in a way. And I mean, there's a lot of talk right now, sort of, let's say, Luddite romanticism about, you know, moving on, the tragedy of moving on from film. It's really interesting because film wasn't around long enough really to be that romantic about, you know. Although I do understand there are elements of it which I'll miss.
Tell us about the movie then. You've just finished cutting, and that is tackling the intellectual idea of the suspension of disbelief.
It came originally as a sketch in my head, which stemmed from a dissatisfaction with what we were doing, certainly what I was doing, with film and how film relates to an audience. Because film is our contemporary version of theatre, you know. In other words, it's visual narrative storytelling. Mm-hmm. And the rules of suspension of disbelief were very simple in theatre, which is, you know, you come in and see my play, and I, you know, kind of ask you to please suspend your disbelief. It's not, a castle in America or whatever. You know, it's a stage, and you can see all the props moving, and you know the actors are all projecting, and nothing's real. But if I do my job halfway decently, and you get carried along by the story, you will suspend your disbelief. You will do that. In theatre, that's a very simple contract, because if it's not working, people actually start itching and leaving and booing. A long time ago, filmmakers ceased to be bothered about that contract with the audience, you know. And films now cheat in a way that I find unacceptable. You know, the audience ceases to be attached to the idea psychologically in the way that we would really want them to be. My film is, in a way, an accessible dialogue.
It's so easy to write an opening sequence. Most films have interesting beginnings.
It seems that the area of the brain that deals with emotion does not differentiate between truth and fiction.
Good morning, Inspector Bullock. We're investigating a missing person, a young lady last seen at this address.
I want to explain some things about my sister. Something terrible happened.
So
signs of a sexual assault.
She was brilliant at impersonating people.
You're using a smaller camera, you're using a smaller crew, and you're shooting it in 21 days. Mm-hmm. This presumably is something where you can mess up and go back to it, and you can gauge the level of the subtlety of, mm-hmm. of how you want to use this.
It is a return to something that, you know, emerges from time to time in yeah. cinema. I mean, I talk about people like John Cassavetes and obviously the Nouvelle Vague directors like Godard and Truffaut and so on, where periods in film and in the English New Wave with Carol Rice and his contemporaries, where films were made at a budget, which wasn't going to sort of bankrupt anyone. There was a working script. And then the most important business of filmmaking was left open, which is what happens on the day, where's the light, what are the actors like, what can we create now based on, I mean, obviously a script has to be there because more than anything else, filmmaking involves many people and you need to organize what day they turn up, what clothes the actors are wearing, what you're going to feed the crew for lunch. And the script becomes the basis. That's just a working blueprint. That's all it is. Once you get on the set and you start working properly, creatively, maybe the words you've written aren't that great suddenly because a much better idea presents itself to you. I remember walking across a Hollywood studio complex with the head of the studio who was trying to help me at the time. Mm. Because I was screwing up as far as he was concerned. And he put his arm around me, and he was in a fatherly way. He said, Mike, you've got to understand, it's not the film you're making now that is important. It's the film you might make next. And I thought, I thought about that long and hard. I mean, it's a very profound, true Hollywood statement. Because it's about ongoing commerce, you know. The fact, in other words, don't worry about the quality, just worry about your job, you know. You learn as a filmmaker, that's why the older you get, I think the better you get, to be honest. What you learn is how to take an idea which is spontaneous, which you might have right now, and write it down, go, wow, great. And then how to convert that into pieces that are going to be deconstructed, and then hold that in your head as a whole image. Even though you will be constantly taken out of the mood, it's a little voice that tells you while you're directing each scene, you know, think of the big picture, think of the big picture. This is not a film. This is just one scene. It's really about the sum total of things. Now, if you have in your head some image of something that is a whole and how you imagine it as a deconstruct, that would help.
That was director Mike Figgis, and Mike's new film, Suspension of Disbelief, premieres this week on the 6th of July, to be exact, at the East End Film Festival here in London. The festival's running until the 10th of July. It's well worth a visit. If you're here in the city, just visit eastendfilmfestival.com for all the juicy details. Still to come in part two, we get another slice of Sansa with some more of her Midori House session. We'll hear what happens when opera comes to your Wohnzimmer in Berlin. We'll loiter in Seoul's most indie-tastic district to learn more about the music business there. And we'll soak up a minute of sound from Beirut's recent Fête de la Musique, a musically diverse and rich second half for you coming up there on Culture on Monocle 24. OK, so first up, let's get a taste of that mesmerising session from Finnish songstress Sansa. The following track may give the impression that she was not alone or that she'd recorded some tracks in advance. But no, she did all of this in one go, live just for us, before sitting down for a chat with culture producer Katie Bilboa. But first, here she is with Sorry, My Love. Ding a 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 ding
sorry, my love. I didn't mean to make you cry. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to make you cry. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. Those pretty days are gone when we soaked in the sun naked, breathing in and out. There was nothing we couldn't do. You took my hand to show the most beautiful sunset. I took yours to unveil the endless sky. Oh, what a lie. I said the endless sky was a lie. I didn't mean to make you cry. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to do you wrong. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to break your heart. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to do you wrong. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I'm sorry, my love. I'm sorry, my love. I haven't seen you in years. Where might you be? I hope you'd forgiven me things I've done that made you blue. I wish you'd understand it hasn't been that easy for me to get along with life. Well, sometimes I forget all the good I have. Hey, I do forget all the good I have. I didn't mean to make you cry. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to break your heart. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to do you wrong. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to make you cry. I'm so sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to make you cry. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to do you wrong. Sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to do you wrong. Sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. I didn't mean to make you cry. Sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. Sorry, my love. Sorry, my love.
I have a looper that I'm working with, and it basically I'm recording like rhythms and some harmonies. Then the looper plays it. It's called live looping.
And are you always performing solo like that then?
Sometimes I'm performing with my band as well.
And okay.
Then the band is more like in the front.
And how did you develop that sound with the looping?
Well, I just thought it's really interesting. In Finland, it's not always possible to get the band on board, you know what I mean? So I just thought that it would be so fantastic to create my own layers, to create my own bigger orchestra of Sansa.
And your album, Saviour, is quite eclectic, isn't it, in the types of music you kind of cover. How would you describe your sound?
I'm creating music, which is pop music, obviously, and it can be played under mirror balls.
And so that's the aim, something that can always be played under a mirror ball.
Yeah, under a mirror ball, yeah. Just kidding, yeah. In my music, there are like folk influences, from folk music and country music and pop music and some disco flavours as well.
So let's talk about where you come from in Finland. I'm not going to try and pronounce the name of the town you're from.
Yeah.
Maybe you can do it for me.
Okay, it's called Seinäjoki.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My colleague Marcus Hippie informs me this is a fairly small town in the west of Finland.
It is quite small.
So growing up somewhere like that, how did you learn about music and where were you getting your music from? Were you listening to the radio? Or?
Yeah, I listened to the radio quite a lot. I mean, it's a pretty small town and there wasn't that many things to do. And I played soccer and that was my like passion. And then when I was in my early teens, I listened to the radio and there was like Alanis Morissette, Nirvana and Björk. And I was like, what is this music? Why it feels like this? And then my brother had a guitar and I just picked it up and started to strum with it.
And how old were you when you were doing that then?
I was like 14 or 15. And then I just felt so happy. I was blown away by it.
And so did that replace football, presumably?
Yeah, exactly. That replaced football.
Probably your most famous song, I guess, today is your cover of Sabrina's song, Boys.
Yeah.
I've got a little clip now to remind people listening of what that song sounded like. Okay. So we're just going to hear that first. For those people who don't know the Sabrina song, this is what it sounds like. So that is Boys by Sabrina, and that's the song that you covered. Now, your version is very much different from that. But before we talk about that, I have to say, I watched the Sabrina video to that song for the first time today, and I was quite shocked at how, I guess explicit might be the word, but she is wearing a bikini, and she is not always completely in that bikini, is she?
No, she's not. Yeah, it's like really famous, this one scene when she's rising out of the...
Out of the water.
Of the water, yeah.
She's sort of kind of spilling out of her bikini top.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah. It's so funny. Yeah.
What made you want to cover that? Is that a song that you grew up with?
Kind of. Yeah, I remember I saw the video on MTV when I was like quite small. And
the famous video.
The famous video, yes. And then I was like, this song is so good. This song is so good. And a couple of years ago, I was looking for songs that might be good for doing it, you know, cover version. And then I was like, oh, Sabrina's Boys. I have to try it out. Let's see how it goes. I'm going to do my own version of that song. And then it's a totally different kind of interpretation.
It is really different, isn't it? But it's beautiful the way you've put your kind of own spin on it. I think when people hear your version and then they hear the original, they wouldn't necessarily make that connection immediately, which is what's really nice about it, I think.
Okay, thanks. Nice to hear. So
have you got any more covers in the pipeline, do you think?
Well, I'm covering the song Something Got Me Started by Simply Red.
Okay. Mick Hucknall.
Yeah, it's totally crazy. Whereas but it's really nice. I love the song.
And is that out now or is that something you're working on?
I'm working on, yeah. I'm playing it when I'm doing those shows.
So okay.
It's not recorded yet. I don't know if it will ever be, but let's see. You never know.
That was Sansa talking covers with Katie. And we'll be treating you to her cover of Boys at the end of the show. If you like what you heard there, Sansa has new material on the horizon. You can keep up to date at sansamusic.com. You're tuned in to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. Well, before we head to Korea to hear about the indie music business in Seoul, it's time to cross to Germany for a different type of performance altogether. Berlin receives nearly €1 billion in art subsidies every year, which is why it can afford the luxury of 3 state-funded opera houses. The city, as we know, is a hotbed of pop-up restaurants, boutiques and galleries, a trend that speaks volumes of the demographic shifts going on. But pop-up culture has now crept up the cultural ladder to take on opera. So how does this grandest of art forms downsize? Reporter Dorothy Fever went to find out at a recent, rather intimate, performance.
When successful mezzo-soprano Hedna Brun left Copenhagen in 2011, she was looking for a fresh start.
I was bored in the opera. I was like, this is boring. And I'm thinking, if I'm bored and I'm a singer, then the audience would get bored.
It's a glorious summer's evening in Berlin, and I've come up to Mitte in the northeast of the city, where most people seem to be making their way on foot or by bike to Mauerpark to catch the last of the evening rays. I've got an address that was only sent to me this morning. Hopefully it's going to lead me to my first taste of home opera. Secret addresses are something I'd associate with warehouse parties rather than opera. There's a cute sticker pointing guests to the fourth floor. We're in a minimalist apartment with double height ceilings and light pouring in from balconies on either side. Chairs are set out for around 40 guests in front of an orange sofa and a piano. There's no box office, no dress code, and no one frowns when the toilet flushes. Three singers present their favourite repertoire. There's Mozart, Puccini and Cole Porter, linked by jokier sides. And it's been chosen by consensus, under Hettner's guidance. Hettner is a tall, graceful woman with a DIY attitude. She tells me that Berlin was the spark for the concept.
Germany is one of the greatest places to be right now as a culture person or musician.
But when she first moved here, she was in despair.
I did a couple auditions and then, you know, I didn't think it went very well. I emptied a bottle of wine thinking, I'm not going to be a singer anymore. Then I had a cup of coffee with my friend, a Danish friend who is a curator here in Berlin, and she have a really nice flat with high ceiling and a piano. And then I ask her, you know, can I come and sing in your apartment? I'll bring a couple of singers and whatnot.
We found, at least, that Germans are a bit more, like, culturally erudite. And that's more difficult to find in Denmark.
Production assistant Stefan Madsen.
Berlin's got a great tradition of, like, house music, like, salon, like, taking music into the living rooms. And I feel people are more open to open up their homes to complete strangers like this and be like, okay, well, this is my home, come and enjoy some opera music with me.
In 19th century Germany, house music existed in parallel to the growing public realm of performing arts, and amateur groups of musicians might make it through to the professional world. Today, the relationship has swung the other way. Baritone Alec Loza has flown in from Moscow.
Usually, when you go to a small concert in some apartment in Moscow, it means that people who sing there, they're not quite successful. Regina Mizerny and Hetna, they're all successful singers. They sing in international theatres and quite successful too.
With his long blonde hair and silky shirts, he brings swagger to the living room.
Usually when you go on stage and you sing, you just stay there and sing. You don't talk, you don't actually get crazy sometimes, and it's so interesting. It's so interesting to speak about what you sing. I like to get crazy, actually.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
I like no.
It was funny.
No, it was funny. I like to. In Moscow, I'm a son of a pop artist, and I try to bring this pop attitude to an opera.
Alec even finds a moment to do the robot. And later, dainty Polish soprano Katarzyna Mizerny flings herself off a chair and rolls on the floor laughing, something that wouldn't happen in her day job at Denmark's Royal Opera House.
I love to be so close to the audience because I can feel the energy, and it's amazing. It's like dialogue between us on the stage and people. When people love it, we are just giving even double of what we usually are giving. So it's amazing. It's reaction, it's cooperation.
As dusk falls, resident pianist Markus Siperek reflects on the surge of professional singers in Berlin of recent years.
You have these three big opera houses here. They only have, 20 singers. So you don't really have the chance to get in there. And when you have so many people around you, the competition, of course, can be very cruel. Yeah.
And in a cruel way, maybe that raises the standard.
Yeah, of course. It raises a standard, and we are much more international now than 20 years ago.
Hettner wants the process to be a pleasure rather than a pain.
For example, when we had auditions, I decided that I want them to sing the full aria, and we clap and we were actually smiling at them. We had so many great responses of that, you know, even we turned them down, people saying, this was my first good audition ever or something like this, and I'm trying to change it in the small things that, you know, not working against each other like we did a lot, but help each other and be nice and be respectful, not least.
But for all her impatience with the system, Hettner acknowledges that her pop-up, now trademarked, has flourished thanks to the culture nurtured by benevolent arts funding. Berlin's great opera houses, the Deutschoper, Staatsoper and Komischoper, attract a wealth of performers to the city. Could home opera take off elsewhere? That question will be put to the test by future performances lined up in Rome and Nairobi. It's something I hope we'll be hearing more of. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Dorothy Fever.
Thanks, Dorothy. And if you're interested in checking out opera in a living room, Fear not. The Home Opera Gang are doing a couple of dates in Copenhagen in early August to tie in with the city's opera festival. Just visit homeopera.net for more details. This is Culture on Monocle 24. Next up, all aboard the Indie Express. Destination Seoul.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the weekend edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we head now to Seoul for a slice of musical education. Regular listeners to Monocle 24 will be no strangers to K-pop that's all over the playlists. Acts like Wonder Girls, Girls' Generation and, of course, Psy have drawn global attention. But as we heard a few weeks ago when we met Korean act Gunam, back home there's also a thriving indie music scene. It's still fairly niche and, in fact, it's almost entirely centred in one neighbourhood. We wanted to find out more about this corner of town, so we dispatched our Korea correspondent Jason Struther to tell us more about this district around Seoul's Hongik University.
Love X Stereo's hypnotic vocals are what first grabbed my attention. They're an indie band that's been playing the bars and clubs around Hongik University for the past 7 years. After a gig one night, I caught up with the group's lead singer, Annie Ko. She tells me her band takes inspiration from 1990s alternative music, but puts their own twist on it.
We wanted to try to make it a bit more 21st century.
And how do you make it 21st century?
Using synthesizers. We didn't want to make it a very obvious, like, dance-type music.
So it's definitely not K-pop.
Yes, it's not K-pop.
Love X Stereo is a staple of the music scene in this neighborhood, known as Hongdae for short. But here, music isn't confined to indoor venues only. Outside, the sound of guitars and drums echo down the alleys. A small park, known as the playground, is packed with a young crowd checking out a live performance. If you're an indie band in South Korea, Hongdae is the place where you get your start. Observers say it's no coincidence that this neighborhood is the epicenter of the country's independent music scene, or any other art form for that matter.
Hongdae is probably, without a doubt, Korea's number one art university, art school. And as a result, by default, that's where all the artists would study, but more importantly, play.
Bernie Cho is CEO of the DSFB Collective, an agency that promotes Korean music overseas.
And so during the early 90s, Hongdae really started out as kind of a hangout for a lot of these artists. Outside the classroom, a lot of that energy, creative energy, spilled over into the clubs, into the bars, into the cafes. For a lot of these indie artists, many of them happened to be students at Hongdae. And if you weren't studying at Hongdae, chances are you were studying somewhere nearby. Hongdae happens to be in the heart of Sincheon, which is Korea's biggest college district. You know, for many, whether you happen to be a hip-hop artist, an electronic artist, or a rock artist, the reality is that Hongdae has so many clubs, live clubs, for these new and emerging talents to not only just break out, but break through. Pretty much any Korean music act that wants to be considered credible and legit, they need that mark, they need that tag, they need that bragging right, that they cut their teeth and that they pretty much were a product of the Hongdae scene, of the Hongdae system.
How bands in the Hongdae system get their start is a lot different from how K-pop acts get theirs, says Cho. Huge entertainment companies south of Seoul's Han River in ritzy Gangnam assemble those groups, give them a style, and write their music. Hongdae is more of a DIY environment, and Cho says that the lack of corporate backing hasn't stopped some bands from making it big.
A lot of the top hot Hongdae acts are making that leap, not only crossing over the river, but crossing over into radio, TV, and now, more importantly, crossing over to overseas markets.
Third Line Butterfly is one of those bands that has hit the top of the charts after earning its Hongdae street cred. The group started playing the scene about 15 years ago. They recently won Album of the Year at the Korean Music Awards, and for the past 2 years, they've played South by Southwest. Nam Sung-ah, the band's lead singer, and guitarist Song Ki-won tell me that Hongdae has gone through some big changes since when they first started performing there.
What was the atmosphere like at that time?
There were really few, in the 90s, there were really few clubs, like, you can count in one hand, you know, like, not really a lot of people. If it's a small club, you can feel it, but, you know, we were beginning, so we were really enthusiastic, so it didn't matter.
We were part of in this very, very sincere musical scene. The bands that we know are friends. They don't lie with their music. It's true. We are true to the music. I really feel that I'm proud to be in a part of that scene. That's the most precious and, you know, important thing that makes us keep going on.
Do you still feel the Hongdae scene is as warm as it used to be?
I think it's warmer. I think the audience are more open-minded than before. The number of audience increased also, and you can see that their faces, they're like more open, they're like enjoying themselves better.
Nam and Song say you can never be too big for Hongdae. Third Line Butterfly is still on the scene. But Hongdae's growing popularity has come with a price, says DSFB Collective's Bernie Cho.
Now you have all of these franchises that want to get in and want to cash in on this hip, cool street cred factor. And what's happening is it's driving some of these smaller clubs out of that neighborhood. It has, in some ways, become a victim of its own success.
For Annie Ko, Love X Stereo's lead singer, finding new venues outside of Hongdae doesn't sound like such a bad thing. She says her band hopes to broaden its horizons.
I would like to see a big breakthrough. It would be nice to know that there's somewhere else that we can perform.
So you kind of think maybe that even though Hongdae is the epicenter of mm-hmm. indie music, that it you think it's kind of limiting?
Yeah, in a way, yeah. Because Hongdae is a very small pool. Even if you get famous, it's hard to expect a lot. Our goal is to get out of here.
The American music magazine Blurt recently added Love X Stereo to its list of best-kept secrets. If that kind of buzz keeps up, Annie Ko might soon get her wish. For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
Thank you, Jason, and this is Culture with me, Robert Bound. If you've just tuned in, we're nearly at the end of the show, but luckily for you, there's still plenty to enjoy because the Minute of Sound is back. Yes, time for a 60-second soundscape, which is at once enlightening, confusing, bemusing, and intriguing. It's not about making sense, it's about capturing something. A feeling, a spirit, an emotion, perhaps. But enough of this waffle, let's just get in there. The 13th Fête de la Musique took place recently in Lebanon, a festival which, for one night, takes over the whole city with performances in each corner of town. Missed it? Well, luckily Rebecca Collard was there, so take a minute to experience it now. Oh, That was a minute of sound from the Fête de la Musique in Beirut, courtesy of Rebecca Collard. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be asking whether the Montreal Jazz Festival has helped to rebrand the city. And we'll be taking a kind of retrospective look at Amy Winehouse, courtesy of London's Jewish Museum. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Lolita Laguna stood in for Dear Holly this week and did a sterling job. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch, you always can. I'm on rb@monocle.com. Katie is kb@monocle.com. And time for one final song this week from her Midori House session, and something you'll likely recognize if you're a regular Monocle 24 listener. This is Sansa with Boys. Thank you very much for tuning in.
Sun shines down, so come to town and set your body free. Hold me tight, my love, tonight. Tell me you believe. Everybody, summertime love, you remember me. Everybody, summertime love, be my lover, be my baby. Boys, 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 I'm looking for a good time. Boys, 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 get ready for my love. Boys, 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 I'm looking for a good time. Boys, 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 I'm ready for your love. Sun goes down, oh babe, I'm feeling right. Take a chance with a love romance and have some fun tonight. Everybody, summertime love, you remember me. Everybody, summertime love, be my lover, be my baby. Boys, 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 I'm looking for a good time. Boys, 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 get ready for my life.